from Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College, this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Sam Hirschman.
And I'm Caroline Batten.
This week on War News Radio, Without Shelter, we examine the causes of homelessness among veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
There's also still some lingering from the years before my time either, I think, a fear of veterans, especially combat veterans, the old going postal in, that some employers may be afraid of hiring, especially those that have ended up involved in the legal system due to their military and combat experiences.
Then we hear about Libyan youth movements.
Both kind of had like this love-hate relationship with Libya. We wanted to know our country but never could due to the situation there.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
Mustafa Abdel Jalil, chairman of the National Transitional Council of Libya, or NTC, is urging NATO to continue its military presence in the country until the end of this year. Abdel Jalil's statement comes days after NATO announced a preliminary decision to formally end operations in Libya by October 31st. The NTC officially declared the end of the conflict and promised to hold elections for a National Constituent Assembly within 8 months. Nonetheless, Abdel Jalil has cited the challenges of dealing with Gaddafi loyalists and containing the spread of arms within Libya.
Abdel Jalil also announced plans to investigate the circumstances surrounding the death of Muammar Gaddafi. The NTC says Gaddafi was killed in the crossfire between NTC fighters and pro-Gaddafi fighters outside of Sirte. However, video footage shows Gaddafi being beaten by his captors. An autopsy from Libya's chief pathologist reported Gaddafi died from close-range gunshots to the head, not, as the NTC stated, as a result of crossfire. Officials have since announced the burial of Gaddafi's body in a secret location.
Tunisia held their first democratic election since ousting the regime of Zine El Abidine Ben Ali in December 2010. Poll results show Ennahda, a moderate Islamist party, winning about 40% of seats in Tunisia's 217-seat National Constituent Assembly. A group of large, liberal, and widely secular parties comes in second, with about 28% of the vote. The Assembly, a temporary body, will be responsible for drafting a new constitution. It will address such issues as civil liberties, the role of religion in civic life, division of state power, and economic policy. A delegation of observers from the Council of Europe reports that voter turnout was high and that the elections were free and fair. Tunisia's elections, much like the revolution which preceded them, set the bar for democratic reform in other Arab Spring nations.
A United Nations Security Council resolution brokered by Yemen's Arab Gulf neighbors proposes immunity from prosecution to Yemeni President Abdullah Saleh. In return, Saleh would resign and hand his power to his vice president, ending his 33-year rule. Saleh's refusal to sign the resolution instigated protests in Yemen's capital Sana'a, resulting in a clash between troops loyal to Saleh and renegade troops led by Major General Ali Mohsen. 12 protesters were killed and at least 40 were wounded during the violence. Saleh has been battling protesters for 9 months.
The United States Department of Justice is preparing charges against 4 citizens of Singapore and 1 from Iran, after electronic parts made in Minnesota were identified in improvised explosive devices, or IEDs, targeting U.S. troops in Iraq in 2008 through 2010. 16 radio control parts made by American manufacturer Digi International and sold to a company in Singapore for a telecommunications project were allegedly resold from Singapore to Iranians while evading U.S. laws against business transactions with Iran.
Turkish military forces are continuing attacks against Kurdish fighters on the border between Turkey and Iraq. The offensive is in response to one of the deadliest attacks launched by the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, since they began their armed struggle for independence in 1984. Turkish tanks and armored vehicles have entered northern Iraq and are heading towards a Kurdish military camp, which is about 12.5 miles inside Iraq. The escalation of Turkey's offensive raises concerns that Turkey will attack PKK camps that lie deeper inside northern Iraq. Turkey has requested Iran's support in fighting Kurdish rebels, but both U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and U.S. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta have warned Iran against interfering in Iraq.
Afghan and NATO forces killed or captured 200 opposition fighters in eastern Afghanistan, including 20 members of the Haqqani Network. The strikes come after U.S. State Department officials met with a Haqqani Network representative in Pakistan, though Secretary of State Hillary Clinton played down this meeting in testimony before Congress. Tensions between the United States and the Haqqani Network have escalated since the militant group orchestrated an attack on the U.S. Embassy in Kabul in September.
Israel's cabinet has agreed to trade 25 Egyptian prisoners currently detained in Israel in return for the release of Ilan Grabel, an Israeli-American who has been imprisoned in Egypt since June. The Egyptian government accused Grabel of espionage, but Israeli and American officials have denied those claims. The exchange comes in the wake of an Egyptian-facilitated swap of 1,027 Palestinian prisoners for the release of Gilad Shalit, an Israeli soldier who had been held captive by Hamas for 5 years.
This is War News Radio. According to the National Coalition for Homeless Veterans, around 100,000 veterans are homeless on any given night. Almost half of those served during the Vietnam War era. American military presence in Iraq and Afghanistan is scheduled to draw to a close, meaning that the largest influx of troops since Vietnam will be returning to America. 1.8 million troops are serving or have served in those two wars, according to Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. In part one of a series on homelessness among veterans, Amandine Lee explores the difficulties and narratives of the newest generation of war heroes.
Ross Falacaro was discharged from the military in July of 2004, after serving for 4 years in Afghanistan. At the ripe young age of 26, he had not much family to return to, no higher education, and was officially diagnosed with PTSD.
I tried to make it on my own, on the outside. I really didn't have the tools to make it on my own. So, you know, I drank and I did what I thought was right. I became a bartender, and, you know, my life was slowly but surely deteriorating, and I didn't realize why.
Falacaro became homeless, like many other veterans from Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom, the official names for U.S. involvement in Afghanistan and Iraq, respectively. For Falacaro and his cohort, transitioning into civilian life, already notoriously difficult, is complicated by a number of factors, including a bad economy, high rates of post-traumatic stress disorder among veterans, and the misunderstandings of the American public. As it stands, the Department of Veterans Affairs reports that more than 10,000 of OIF and OEF veterans are either homeless or in programs designed to alleviate homelessness. So what exactly is causing these veterans to become homeless? One huge problem is the difficulty of finding jobs. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, overall, the U.S. unemployment rate is hovering around 9%. Then, there are challenges facing veterans specifically. Sherry Balter is an independent psychologist who works with Stand Down House, a transitional living facility in Lake Worth, Florida, to treat veterans with mental health and addiction issues.
A lot of our veterans, like many in our nation, are dealing with unemployment. And when you're dealing with our returning OIF, OEF veterans, their unemployment rate is drastically higher than civilian counterparts of the same age group. They have more difficulty finding employment, especially, again, our returning veterans, since the skills that they learn in service and on the battlefield are not easily translated into civilian occupations.
In addition to difficulty finding a market for military skills, veterans often encounter misunderstandings from potential employers, specifically regarding post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, which is a mental health disorder that can follow traumatic experiences. Until treated, symptoms can include flashbacks, nightmares, phobias, and a heightened startle response.
There's also still some lingering from the years before my time, either, I think, a fear of veterans, especially combat veterans, the ongoing postal image that some employers may be afraid of hiring, especially those that have ended up involved in the legal system due to their military and combat experiences. And people often see a felony or an addiction, and the employers aren't really looking any further.
Then, there are restrictions to the type of work available to veterans due to injuries sustained in combat.
Plus, of course, any that suffered amputations and worse traumatic brain injury, they can't compete for the same jobs. They're not able to do the same jobs that they would have been able to prior to their injury. And especially traumatic brain injury, because looking at the person, if there wasn't a significant head trauma with it, no one would know. They'll just see these personality changes, these odd affect from the person. Pain issues can impair their ability to take care of themselves, to hold employment.
The war's effects on mental health can also inhibit veterans' ability to work and impact their general quality of life.
Dealing with mental health issues, be it leading to addiction, flashbacks, or other issues, can hinder employment and therefore financial stability, relationships, and as relationships will wither and have problems, many of these individuals end up on the streets rather than with spouses or families.
Even for a veteran with a clean medical record after the war, returning to civilian life can be difficult. For Falacaro, the inability to deal with trauma issues and the stress of coming home led to substance abuse and away from a healthy and productive lifestyle.
And I never dealt with the issues of what I experienced traumatically in the Middle East. And I never dealt with my issues of transitioning from a person in the military back to civilian life. So the transition process for me was covered up with the substance, and that substance was alcohol.
On the whole, however, veterans are only slightly more likely to be homeless than the general population. According to the 2009 Annual Homeless Assessment Report, conducted by the Department of Housing and Urban Development, former service members make up 10% of the overall U.S. population, but 12% of the homeless population. John Kuhn is acting national director for the VA Supported Services for Veteran Families program. He notes that certain populations within former service members are overrepresented among the homeless.
Within that population, there are important subsets where risk is quite a bit higher. And those subsets include veterans who are in poverty, female veterans, younger veterans, and minorities.
The reasons why these groups are susceptible aren't entirely known. The Balter points out that those at-risk younger veterans often had to grow up on the battlefield.
Their first learning who they are, their identity, figuring out kind of what they want to be when they grow up, their morals, their beliefs and values. That's natural for late teen, early 20s, and that gets disrupted. They also often find, at any age, a sense of satisfaction and purpose that when they then come out of service, they feel is lacking. They don't know what their purpose is anymore.
For women, the stigma against seeking help for mental health problems, already well established among troops with tough, independent self-images, is particularly strong, says Dr. Balter.
For our female veterans, who often feel the additional difficulty of surviving in a traditionally male environment and not wanting to be seen as weak if they admit to these mental health difficulties or coping difficulties.
According to the annual homeless assessment report, most homeless veterans are between 31 and 61 years old, in keeping with the fact that the vast majority of America's veterans come from older wars. However, Kuhn says that if Iraq and Afghanistan follow the pattern established in the Vietnam era, homelessness may not show up immediately.
Early after the conflict, you didn't see lots of veterans becoming homeless right away. And homelessness is a condition that develops over time. Our veterans coming out of these war zones will have other supports initially. So by the time they work through all those things, they can slip into homelessness, and that can take years.
Balter, however, has noticed that the process by which veterans become homeless seems to be expedited this time around.
And that's actually one difference, is our returning service members are becoming homeless much faster than our veterans of previous wars. For example, after Vietnam, it took an average of 10 years for a Vietnam vet to end up homeless, and an average OAF-OEF veteran is often homeless within 18 months after coming back.
One big difference between these wars and previous wars is that they're being fought without a draft. Reserve troops, for example, were called into duty, which means that they don't have access to the same social support network as active troops, says Balter.
They're not located near bases. Actually, they're not hooked into family readiness groups. A lot of these individuals were kind of living their lives and doing their guard or reserve duty. Now they're kind of pulled out of any of their civilian life, not knowing if their jobs are going to be kept for them.
In addition, according to Kuhn, the types of new recruits changed over the course of the war.
Early in the war, the volunteer army was highly educated. Also, right after 9/11, I think there was a much greater interest in serving the country. We had the veterans who were involved might have been different than the group later on, where we still had excellent caliber of troops, but of course at that point the military was desperate to fill some of the roles of their troops, and recruiting was more of a challenge.
Overall, Falcaro's analysis is that he is just among the first of a growing group of veterans.
I have a feeling there's going to be a much larger population for the years to come, because I know what I went through, I know what friends of mine went through, and I know that there's people from my era that haven't dealt with these issues yet that I've been dealing with. They just haven't faced them yet, so.
This leaves a challenge for the Department of Veterans Affairs and community groups to try and get veterans off the streets, or better yet, address the issues before they lead to homelessness. Next time, I will analyze and explore the effectiveness of the VA. For War News Radio, I'm Amandine Lee.
This is War News Radio. The implications of new technologies are vast and sometimes unpredictable. Recent revolutions in Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya have highlighted the power of social media to affect change. Young people especially have proved adept at using new media to coordinate movements. War News Radio's Hannah Kozlowska spoke with two young Libyans about leading an online community through the current crisis.
Sleep can wait. Libyan students in two different time zones took shifts to manage the information flowing in from Libya via social media. Within a few months, they gathered 41,000 Twitter followers, and their Facebook page was liked by 20,000 users. Omar Amr, only 24 years old, was interviewed four times a day by various international media, from the Los Angeles Times to ABC Australia.
At that point, my phone didn't stop ringing all day. Literally, I finished the day with about 50 calls and invitations to newsrooms.
Ayat Mnena is a 23-year-old Libyan living in Canada, hoping to end up in Libya one day.
Arman and I are really passionate about Libya and helping this move forward.
On February 17th, the Libyan people started their fight for freedom after 42 years under the Gaddafi regime. During the first weeks of the revolution, the government did not allow any foreign journalists into the country. Libya was under a complete media blackout. And this is where the Libyan Youth Movement, an international online community, stepped in. Amr, UK-born Libyan, living in Manchester, England, along with his friend Mnena, launched Twitter and Facebook accounts in order to fill in the media gap. They established a network of contacts all around Libya who would email, tweet, post and Skype in with information from the ground in real time. Now, while Libya is preparing for an all-encompassing transformation, the members of the Libyan youth movement are doing work on the ground and hoping to be a platform for the voices of Libyan youth. For Amr, violent events in Libya hit close to home. Within 2 days of the revolution, Benghazi, his father's hometown, was under siege.
200 people were shot with an anti-aircraft firearm.
Amr and Mnena realized they could be the ones to start up the coverage of Libyan events. What started with a network of friends and cousins grew with astonishing speed.
On February 17th, we had 200 followers on Facebook. Overnight, we got about 5,000 that first night, something like that.
Amr, a busy student in the United Kingdom, put everything on hold to help out with the most important political and social movement that his home country had experienced in decades.
For the first few weeks, we were on literally 24 hours a day.
Because they were in the UK and Canada, in two different time zones, they were able to provide coverage virtually around the clock. Amr's two-bedroom apartment in Manchester was transformed into the group's headquarters, with meetings around his dining room table.
Dedicated, like one of the most dedicated people to this cause, definitely behind the scenes, and that's kind of like how he likes it.
Amr's family in Libya has always been in the anti-Qaddafi opposition. Although Amr's father was forced to leave Libya when he was only 21, he raised his children in a spirit of love for the country.
All Libyans in the UK and other places across the world were raised not to forget their roots and not to forget that they're Libyan. Just because we couldn't go there didn't mean we weren't Libyan. So this is how we were raised.
So with the revolution underway, it didn't really matter that they couldn't be there.
We had a connection from birth, if you like, to the country. So we felt a sense of responsibility, you know, as Libyans in the West, that we had to play our role.
Their knowledge of English and Arabic and contacts with the Western media helped them participate in the revolution from a distance. But Amr actually did end up in the midst of the events. One day, he was chatting with his friend Riyad on Facebook.
I said to him, "Do you want to go to Libya?" He said, yeah, without a doubt. He's got a fiancé there, you see.
It was not a difficult decision.
So he said to me, "Let's go then." So literally, 10 minutes after that conversation, we booked a ticket. We didn't know what we were doing, and we didn't know why we were doing it. We just ended up booking a ticket, and then we asked ourselves, what the hell have we just done?
They flew to Cairo and drove 23 hours nonstop to Benghazi. Amr describes being welcomed at the border crossing as a one-of-a-kind experience.
The whole border crossing was just controlled by youth. With AK-47s, it really was overwhelming seeing the flag, the independence flag, painted across the border crossing and hundreds of checkpoints all the way from the border down to Benghazi.
Although Amr and his friend wanted to go to the front lines, they didn't plan on fighting.
Because we'd had no experience in fighting, so it would be an absolute waste of time.
Instead, they went as journalists, equipped only with some basic cameras, trying to get the perspective of an average person.
So we tried to get another picture and show what the girls are doing, what the boys are doing, what the families are doing, and how they're coping with the revolution.
Amr's uncle told him to go back to the UK to do his work from there. Above all, he told him to resume his studies because he would be needed when the country reopened.
So I took his advice and I just left Libya 3 weeks because I found that I was more efficient in the UK.
Amr says he was hooked on Libya since the first time he visited in 2004. Both Amr and Mnena see their passion for Libya as complicated.
We both kind of had like this love-hate relationship with Libya. We wanted to know our country but never could due to the situation there.
Even though the situation prior to the revolution deeply depressed him, Amr says he would have moved there even if the regime were still in place.
I'm just really happy that things have changed in the right way now, that we can speak our minds, we have freedom of speech, or we will do very shortly across the whole of the country.
If asked a few months ago, he says he probably would have said he wanted to get into politics, but the crazy time of the revolution with its countless daily interviews made him change his mind.
And I think I have full faith in the Libyan people who went out and protested and all the rest of it. I think I have full faith in them to make the right decisions for the country.
Though he says he might feel differently when he's older, for now he just wants to work from the bottom up. Mnena, who describes her friend as charismatic, intelligent, and confident, has a different opinion.
But I kind of see him doing more than being just a pilot. Like, I really do think he would take on maybe development projects or pursue different things in Libya, not just kind of that one career.
Like its leaders, the Libyan youth movement is shifting gears. They've already started to do groundwork, especially with orphaned children or youth under trauma. They've also been working with the Libyan National Transitional Council, an interim political body that currently represents Libya on the international arena. However, Amr emphasizes that they never wanted to join the council.
Because what we wanted to do is provide an independent voice for the Libyan youth.
Amr says that before the revolution, he didn't think the Libyan people would mobilize against Gaddafi. Now, both Amr and Mneina look to the future with hope. Mneina says that Amr finally got to contribute to Libyan society as he had always wanted.
I think it's a very good indication of like the future that Libya would have with you know, these kind of young people playing a role.
Revolutions feed on information. Andy Carvin, senior strategist at the social media desk of NPR, who tweeted 24/7 about the Arab Spring, said in a Harvard University address that on his Twitter feed he saw history playing out in real time. Amr and Mneina played a very important role in providing a hub for information about the revolution. They hoped to take part in the country's transformation. Amr is moving to Libya immediately after graduation from flight school to help out with rebuilding the national airline. The Libyan youth movement will continue to provide an outlet for the young voices of Libya. They also want to bridge the rift created by the Gaddafi regime between Libyans inside and outside the country. For more information, go to shabablibya.org. That's shabablibya.org. Like the Libyan Youth Movement on Facebook or follow their Twitter account, @ShababLibya. For War News Radio, I'm Hannah Kozlowska.
In a final note this week, Afghan President Hamid Karzai made some waves with comments he made to a private Pakistani television station. According to Reuters, he said,
God forbid, if ever there is a war between Pakistan and America, Afghanistan will side with Pakistan.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, in testimony before Congress, said the remarks were taken out of context. Further, she stated that the remarks were intended to demonstrate the strong historical cooperation between Afghanistan and Pakistan. That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archive shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Amy DiPiero, Rosanna Kim, Lucia Luna Victoria, Max Nesterak, Jared Nolan, Chloe Wittenberg, Zach Wunro, and Alan Zapp. I'm Sam Hirschman.
And I'm Caroline Batten. Until next time, thanks for listening.